to our final talk on the geovisualization series, and just a couple of logistical items or actually acknowledgements. I'd like to acknowledge Kathy Hoffman and Bob Techno, who've done all of the audio recording all term long and created the podcast that some of us have been taking advantage of. So really appreciate that. And we also appreciate everyone who has participated in the speakers' visits, joined in for individual appointments with speakers, or participating in lunches or dinners. That's been a really stimulating time throughout the whole 8 or 10 weeks of this term. Thanks to all of you. And Dr. Crippen's visit today is being sponsored by Oregon Space Grant, as well as OSU Geosciences. So thanks to Oregon Space Grant. So, for those of you who were at Dr. Randy Keller's talk last week, he mentioned that the next speaker was going to be Bob Crippen, who was going to knock your socks off. So, as you can see with the 3D glasses, we've fastened our seatbelts here. Bob Crippen is, I think, one of the world's most premier remote sensing earth scientists and digital image processing specialist. He is a research scientist at NASA JPL, NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And he is in the radar science and terrestrial sciences groups at JPL. He's been there for many years and is also now on, still a team member of the Shuttle Radar Topography Mission. And we're going to see some wonderful SRTM images and learn all about that data set during this talk. Bob is an expert in many fields, including geovisualization, but also the development of remote sensing and image processing methodologies, remote sensing investigations in the earth sciences, tectonics and geomorphology. He has a wonderful background, we think, in both geography and geology. He got his degrees in both of those areas, or he got a joint degree in geology and geography from UCLA, and then went on to UC Santa Barbara to get his MA in geology. And then he received an individual interdisciplinary PhD in earth science remote sensing from UC Santa Barbara. And that kind of a special PhD is a situation where you're sort of forging a new science or a new area of inquiry. And it's a degree that can't be given in just one area. And so Bob was at the forefront of the earth system science revolution or boom in the late 80s and early 90s. Now, Bob is somewhat of a living legend at UC Santa Barbara. I told him this today at lunch. I don't think he believed me, but for those of us who were grad students at Santa Barbara after this time, we heard these Bob Crippen stories. He's sort of a role model and an inspiration to us. And you probably don't remember this, Bob, but you came to, well, yeah, I'm sure you remember the UC Santa Barbara Geography Seminar that you gave about the lost city of Ubar. That was, people are still talking about that talk. Because that was a wonderful example of the kinds of research and the kinds of techniques that Bob and his colleagues have developed at JPL. The lost city of Ubar is a situation where they used some really interesting and groundbreaking digital image processing techniques with Landsat images, which reveals this ancient road, a caravan route to this lost city in the Arabian Desert. He's also worked on, for those of you who are interested in earthquake seismology, he's used spot imaging to produce the first visual observations of fault motions in space, and this was with regard to the 1992 Landers earthquake. And I could go on and on here about Bob, but we want to have time to enjoy his presentation. So without further ado, thank you very much, Bob, for coming.
Appreciate all that, and on top of all that, I was born in the Pacific Northwest, so it's nice
That's
to be back.
Right.
If I was a legend at Santa Barbara, it's just because I was a graduate student so long. I found a way to live in Santa Barbara for many years. I didn't like the term professional student, but maybe I was. Okay, I'm going to talk about a Shuttle Radar Topography Mission, better known to us anyway as SRTM. Handed out the 3D glasses, and I'm going to just throw a bunch of 3D pictures up front. I've given some talks like this before. I've got an enormous number of slides here. If I were to bet, I'm not sure I could get through all of them in an hour, but we'll try. I've had out 3D glasses before. I've had scattered 3D pictures through the talk, and I find people are sitting there like, when do I get to use the glasses? So what I've done is put a bunch of them up front here. SRTM mission, I'll give a better introduction later, but basically it was a space shuttle mission with a radar on it in the year 2000. And we were able to create a digital elevation model of about 80% of the Earth's surface by gathering the data in 10 days. When you think about how people have been trying to map the Earth for centuries, and you think about how the military finds this to be a valuable data set and has spent billions of dollars over decades trying to get this data. You can imagine what the military thought when we showed up from JPL and told them that we can basically do what they've been trying to do for decades and have decades to go. We could do it in 10 days. They were a little stunned. Anyway, bottom line is the mission worked. We have DEM. Originally about 30 meter resolution, the military kept most of it to themselves at that resolution. It's degraded slightly. The effective resolution is probably more like 50. It's been released at 90 meter resolution, and that's free to download on the internet. It's extremely easy to get. Okay, with that, let's head into some of the images. Basically, the topic here is looking at Earth's topography. I'm actually going to show some things to get off topic a little bit too, since you have the glasses. As you may know, JPL is the NASA center that sends a space probe out to the other planets. We're the guys who have the rovers driving around Mars and sent the Voyager spacecraft out to Jupiter and Saturn and that kind of thing. But it's a very interesting place to work. I'm going to show a few Mars 3D images on the way. Okay, well, SRTM, again, map the topography of the world, and one of my roles, I get to be play artist. My brother was an artist in the family, but I don't know, I think maybe my art got around more than his. There's a lot of things you can do with this data. One is to look at it in 3D. Of course, Earth's surface is 3D, so that's why I found out the glasses, so you can do that. But of course, you can represent 3D in color and perspectives, and that kind of thing, too. Commonly merged with the Landsat data or other satellite imagery data. But sometimes just color-coded and be seen by itself. Interesting, it changes there, not on the screen. Very bizarre. Okay. What's so great about DEM? Well, if you look at Santa Cruz Island off Santa Barbara Coast, and you look at it in a traditional way, maybe not for you youngsters here, but in the old days when we just had contour maps, this was what the island would look like if you looked at the topography. I call it a bowl of spaghetti. It's really hard to tell in this kind of view what the topography is doing. You take a DEM and shade it, you get a better idea of what's going on. Okay, just because we're so used to seeing 3D objects, they're shape defined by the shading, the illumination. That's false shading. Now, of course, we can take that one step further, and if you put on your glasses, look at that same DEM with shading, and we get this little dark. Shading and 3D, then I could ask people, you know, what is it about the DEM you cannot see in this view? Basically, in every single cell, you can, with the right perspective here, maybe a little degraded here in the auditorium, but basically you can tell how high every spot is, its slope, exposures to other slopes, that kind of thing. You know, you see the 3D surface in 3D, it really tells you what's going on. And, you know, this is extremely valuable information. It's funny how people are so used to seeing topography, they think it's just, it's just topography. We see that all the time. You want to see the topography, you go out and drive through, you can see it. This comes up a lot in science reviews. Why would we want topography? And my response is, why would we not want topography? Who doesn't use it? You know, what process happens at the Earth's surface that isn't affected by the shape of that surface? You know, Southern California, we have different vegetation growing on the north slopes than the south slopes because, you know, evaporation of the moisture is so critical to the vegetation. You know, your water supply comes downhill. Hopefully your sewer drainage goes downhill. Affects climate, weather, rainfall. I was talking to climatologists earlier, you know, they use topography as their main variable to interpolate and extrapolate their weather station data, which is the dominant variable. So who doesn't need topography? Basically controls, I would say it's the dominant geophysical variable in our lives other than maybe weather forecasts. Everybody wants to know what the weather is. Where and what is this? Who knows? This is not 3D, but you can leave the glasses on, it's just great. It's the Grand Canyon. And it is shaded from below. Of course, we're used to seeing illumination from, or illuminated from below. Used to seeing illumination from above. So a lot of you may pick this up, may look like a mountain range. They may have trouble not seeing it as a mountain range. If we go ahead and illuminate the other way, now, for some of you at least, it probably has popped into looking like a canyon. This becomes an issue, the shading becomes an issue when you start looking at 3D. Here's the Grand Canyon illuminated from the south. Again, we're used to illumination coming from above, so here I've got the 3D, the parallax is giving you the depth. But the shading cues are sort of working against you. Their illumination's coming from the south. Some people find this hard to believe, but some people look at this and they still see it as a mountain. Because its shading is so dominant in their perceptual system that it overwhelms the parallax, apparently.
I do.
Yeah. There's always somebody in the audience. That doesn't happen for me. I don't know. But anyway, we switch the illumination. Now, hopefully everybody sees that as a canyon. So you get the shading cue working the same way as the parallax, reinforcing one. There's yet another view you can do here. Well, the view from hell. It's basically what the Earth's surface looks like from the inside out. What I used to do when I had view graphs, and we didn't do PowerPoint, is adjust a view graph and flip it over. You could just, right? So then you basically switch the eyes. Okay, typically, like I said, we also merge this data with satellite imagery, and in that case, you have a couple other things going on. One is you don't have control of the illumination, is whatever it happened to be when you took the picture. Also, the other thing is the shading isn't the only thing that's controlling the brightness, the tone of the image. You've got vegetative effects in here, the north end of the Grand Canyon, looking dark because of the vegetation. But generally, it's an effective tool to turn your satellite images from 2D to 3D. There's another technique besides using these glasses, which when I got this mission, I learned it's cross-eyed stereo, and I've got some examples. I'm gonna try to lead you guys through cross-eyed stereo. I've never done that before. It's fun. Once I learned to do that, and I could make these 3D images, we can make them in color, have the stereo pair side by side. You can also do parallax stereo, where you've got the left image for the left eye and right eye. The trouble is you've got to make your vision go straight. And your eyes don't like to focus close and look straight. That's not what we normally do. So what we do on these things is to take the left and right images and switch them. Your eyes are used to being crossed when they're focusing close. So you can take the two images, stereo pair, cross them, cross your eyes, and on a computer screen without any glasses, see color 3D. I mean, actually color image, undistorted color, in 3D. So we're going to do that later. Okay, a few other things I just threw in here for their interest. I got some images from Hawaii, because it's topographically spectacular place. A lot of the volcanic, of course, they're all volcanic islands. A lot of the islands have major, huge landslides. This is Molokai. The whole northern part up here is just a landslide scarp. The rest of the island's underwater or something. And you look around the Hawaiian Islands, this is quite common. And you can work out the geologic and geomorphic history of some of these places. This is Haleakala in Maui. Of course, you see the volcanic crater here, and one of the more recent eruptions filling the crater and spilling over down the canyon and filling that down here, creating some new landmass out of the ocean. And we're just looking at the topography. You can quite often see geologic history, which is very difficult to see when you're walking around. That's one of those things, you can't see the forest for the trees. If you're looking at the trees, you don't see there's an entire forest in it. When you're walking into one of these canyons or one of these ridges, you just don't see the overall pattern. That's the great power of visualization here, the topographic data. This is the north part of the North Island. Again, there was a big landslide came off here. You can see the piece of the island missing, went down, and then created a steep cliff here, sea cliff. Changed the base level, we've got a lot of erosion coming up here. Some of the sliding created cracks and spreading, and interpret this all just from the department. This one I especially like. I've been to Hawaii a number of times, and I've seen this crack here. And I saw the map's crack here. It wasn't until I stood back and got, you know, what they call the synoptic view, stand back and see the whole thing at once, that I realized this is probably one huge landslide. This is about half the probably one huge landslide that connects through here. This part of the island slid down. It's now been covered by subsequent flows of Mauna Loa. So this has all been smoothed out. Some of this had eroded like we saw in some of the previous images, and subsequent flows came and filled it in somehow. But I never realized this cliff here and that cliff there are probably related. It's just one big slide.
So one of the powers of visualization, again, is the synoptic view. You realize the spatial relationships.
I threw this image in last night. Actually, it didn't come out too bad. It's a 3D image. It's a Landsat thermal image of Woolcut Fault and Pinto Basin and Joshua Tree National Monument. So in this case, I took a Landsat thermal daytime image, draped it over an elevation model, projected it in 3D. And I've walked out along this fault because I've seen it in the Landsat. Extremely subtle in the field. You have to know it's there to see it as you're walking across the it's a relatively flat valley floor. It clearly is there. It's a left lateral east-west fault. It ties right in with the mountain front here. Again, the synoptic view given by the satellite image, thermal data happens to bring out the discontinuity along the fault more distinct than visible or reflectance infrared channels. And then you can tie it into topography and view it in topography with the glasses. Kind of a fun slide. This maps the view from my house. This is the Los Angeles area. Palm Springs down here. Jade Hill is right in here. I have about two blocks from Jade Hill. Main part of Los Angeles. Ventura out this way. About a house up here, and being a topographic scientist of sorts, I wrote up my own line of sight program to see what kind of nice view am I, what can I see from there? And to my shock when I used the bigger data set and ran my new line of sight program, not only could I see the big mountains, these mountains get to 10,000 feet, big mountains around me, but you know, first I ran this data set, okay, fine, I can tell which peak I can see from my house. I ran the bigger data set, these white areas represent what can be seen. 100 miles out to Mount San Jacinto behind Palm Springs, and all the way down to Newport Beach, from my house. And it turns out, I've seen those, and especially the Newport Beach was especially surprising. This is just a 10,000 foot peak. Okay, well, on a very clear day, maybe you can see that, it was a small one. How can I see Newport Beach? It turns out I can see Newport Beach on very rare days where you've got an overcast, very clear atmosphere. Seems like a contradiction. Very clear atmosphere with an overcast. Okay. And what's happening is the overcast is keeping the sunlight off the atmosphere. The atmosphere is not going. It's like a nighttime sky. You can see the stars at night. You can't see them during the day. So if they have the overcast, it keeps the sunlight off the atmosphere. The atmosphere is very clear. I can see, 60, 70 miles down to Newport Beach. Especially if Newport Beach doesn't have the overcast. It's kind of a weird reverse combination. You've got the overcast inland and sunlight down at the beach. But I've actually seen that. So I wouldn't have even looked for it if I hadn't run this program. So, this is kind of fun, but you know, shows another use of elevation data. Cellular phone companies obviously use this data. That's actually one great value of SRTM is it provided that kind of DEM to cell phone companies around the world. We have a uniform 30 meter DEM, which is generally adequate resolution for what they use. They want to see, you know, view sheds, line of sight for their cell towers and what kind of service that provides. We're going way too slow here. I said I was going to throw in some 3D of other planets as I work at JPL. This is a relatively new image. Victoria Crater. If you have your glasses on, you should be able to see that in 3D. This is where one of the rovers are. Table's in the way here. It says Opportunity Rover down here. The Opportunity Rover, one of the two Mars rovers, is currently near the crater here. In fact, if you take this part of the image, rotate it, which makes it lose the 3D, if you flip your eyes, close the right eye, close the left eye, you should see two dots. I put on my glasses, I can see them, that's one of them. Well, the other one's down here. Flick your eyes, you'll see the dots flash on and off. That's how the rover moved. That's the shadow of the rover, basically. That's the rover moving between the acquisition of the two images. This is from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter spacecraft that got to Mars last year. It has that kind of resolution that can actually show the rovers on the surface. You do a lot of fun things to do here. Okay, so back to SRTM. I'll talk a little bit more about the mission. I can talk it all day. Maybe. And the visualizations. And so I will talk about the mission and the visualizations. Some interpretations of the data and understandings we can get from it. Show a little topographic change measurement. SRTM got all its data in 10 days, so it in itself doesn't measure topographic change. It is based on radar interferometry, which has been used to measure extremely small topographic changes like you get in earthquakes, measure movement of the ground. I just find this still amazing. Maybe it's my age, but we used to joke when I first got into remote sensing and do some consulting for the oil companies, wouldn't it be neat if we could write algorithms? You put the satellite picture into the computer and it runs through the algorithm and up comes a map of the bullseye and it says drill here. Right? Well, we haven't been able to do that for oil exploration, but we can do that for mapping earthquakes. Basically, you've got the software, you get a couple of radar images, you run through this interferometry software, and out comes something that looks like a bullseye. That's where the earthquake was. And you're measuring movements of the ground that are only on the order of centimeters. So this technology is just amazing. Now, SRTM is based on that same technology, but instead of measuring the ground motion at centimeter level, it's measuring, you know, elevation model at meters resolution, tens of meters. Anyway, topographic change, how do you get topographic change? Well, I compare it to another DEM before or after. I'll show some of those. It's been useful, data sets been useful for planetary analogs, and I'm going to finish up with, when I get to it, with some recent natural hazards. Okay, mission came out of a shuttle imaging radar series of experiments on the space shuttle. It was actually the first science instrument on the space shuttle on the second flight. The first flight was just to get the shuttle up and down, prove that the shuttle works. Second shuttle flight had shuttle imaging radar A and did radar mapping of the world. In the later missions, we had shuttle imaging radar C. This is one of my favorite images from that. What it shows, the Landsat image on the Nile River, and radar, very dry, grainy material, sand, basically, can look subsurface. And what this image is showing, if you see this bright area here, that you do not see over here, what you're seeing is an old channel of the Nile River under the sand sheet. So the radar is penetrating down, seeing the water carved to bedrock, and showing you the channel where it used to be before it got covered with sand. So imaging radar by itself can be rather amazing, but it was this technology that led to the SRTM mission. So to make a long story short, the guys actually got those experiments done with the imaging radar, we need to continue our careers, what should we do? And they sat down literally with a restaurant napkin and some pens and sketched out some of these details. Okay, you have the orbital geometry, this inclination of orbit towards the pole. What is the spacing of the orbits? How wide can we make the swath? Do we get overlap? What kind of precision can we get? How many days do you have to fly to cover the world? And it worked out well, pushing all the parameters, you could get just enough overlap. You could measure 80% of the world. It would take 10 days, which is a typical shuttle flight. And these ideas came together, and they end up, again, making a long story short, selling it to the military with more money than NASA. But again, just imagine mapping, just getting this kind of data set in 10 days that people have been trying for decades or centuries, depending on how to measure, trying to acquire billions of dollars of dollars. So, end result of that, this is a global view of what we mapped. Because of safety issues, NASA cut the mission short a little bit, which is rather infuriating because the whole time we planned to go the whole 10 day, I think it was 10 and a half days to get the complete data set with overlaps. And for some reason, they decided, because we had the 60-meter boom hanging out of the end, out of the shuttle bay, they were concerned about safety issues they hadn't faced before. And decided to cut the mission short to give them a little more margin there on arriving at the mission. And we hadn't even thought about it. If you cut the mission short, what do you lose? Turns out what you lose is 3 spots in the United States. That's it. And of course, we already have 30-meter elevation data in the United States, so it didn't really matter that much. It lost a little overlap, redundancy in other places, but there's only three, four places here in the United States that we didn't lose anything. You think, well, how does that work? Well, it's, of course, it's in global orbits, it's got to be symmetrical, but if you go to the opposite side of the Earth, you're in the Indian Ocean, and we weren't mapping the oceans anyway. Okay, so bottom line, what do we get out of this? Well, this DEM, the targets were 16-meter vertical, 20-meter horizontal accuracy, and we beat that by a factor of 3 or 4. It took a few years to process this data. I talked about it being acquired in 10 days. It took 2 years to process the data. There were a few glitches along the way, but they were all worked out. Okay, I talked about topographic change, but this isn't so much topographic change, but how does this data set differ from other data sets? If you look at the national elevation data set from the U.S. Geological Survey and do a simple subtraction, here's one of those holes in the United States that just missing data. But you see, I'm representing difference by brightness. You see this brightness, this is the Grand Canyon. Those Grand Canyon images I showed you before, by the way, were not SRTM. They had some problems with voids and rugged terrain. I was using other elevation for that. Some of these dark areas are voids that are water or sea cliffs. But anyway, the brightness representing difference, you get a difference here north of the Grand Canyon, that's forest. The radar is seeing the forest canopy, and the effective measurement's 9 meters. That doesn't necessarily mean the contrary to the way it's worded there. It doesn't quite mean the trees are 9 meters tall, but the radar on average is penetrating the forest canopy down to about 9 meters above the ground. So it's not a perfect measure of the bald earth like you might hope. Some other interesting things, you do these differences, they're San Francisco, do the difference, you get this dendritic pattern here. I thought, how do you create a dendritic pattern over time? And of course, I realized, duh. You know, what you're doing is eliminating the dendritic patterns. Where they got up, they ran out of land service in San Francisco to build homes, so they got out the bulldozers and smoothed out the topography. And if you subtract, you know, the old dendritic from the now smooth, you get the dendritic pattern of the difference. But they say that humans are the dominant, you know, I didn't like the word, I just read this a few days ago, somebody used this phrase, that humans are the dominant geologic force these days. Maybe the dominant geomorphic force, depends on how you define it. It's certainly at high frequencies. Like I said, there's some glitches in the data set. Sandy areas that are too smooth, water areas, and areas that are too rugged for the radar. And I'm going to skip over this very lightly, but there are different routines to patch the data. Where we have voids, this is the Andes. There's other data sets out there, Aster satellites up there, StereoPair, you can create elevation models that don't have great control, but SRTM has the control, you register the two, you patch them to Aster, you get a complete DEM. This looks kind of grainy, but Aster's been patched in. It's using old Aster elevation models that are better. I'll skip that one completely. Touch on this briefly. I played around with filling these holes problem. This is a DEM, SRTM DEM in Pakistan. This is Indus River Gorge. There's this big gap in the data. This is a little test I did. It was published in Geophysical Research Letters 2 months ago. I was talking to the climatologist about this. Like I said, they use topography as a dominant variable to interpolate their climate data, meteorological data. What I did in this paper is basically reverse that process. You know, there's such a great correlation between these two. How about filling in the holes in SRTM by taking temperature measurements? If you have temperature measurements that are pure enough that highly correlate with topography, can you fill holes with a temperature measurement? Well, this, in simple terms, this might work at night where you don't have sun shading kind of things going on during the day. At night, the the microclimates kind of balance out. You end up, in some cases, in very rugged topography, getting the, it's kind of an adiabatic effect. It's actually called the environmental lapse rate, not the adiabatic rate, the actual measured temperature change with elevation. You can get that to be quite pure in some environments. And it turns out in this area, on some dates, the nighttime temperature measured is extremely strongly correlated with topography, and therefore it's kind of a topographic map. Well, if you take the sensitivity to ASTER instrument, divide it by the environmental lapse rate, you get potential measurement of elevation from the ASTER instrument, of just a thermal measurement, of 8 to 14 meters, which in rugged terrain is kind of what SRTM measures. And so we did this study and found that it does have some potential, but needs some refinements to be a good patch. And SRTM, two independent data sets, and if you do this comparison, you can find the glitches in each. USGS has this great elevation data set, but there's some glitches they just didn't know about until compared it to another elevation model. What happened in this one, apparently, they created a DEM by scanning the contours of the topographic map. And apparently somebody missed a contour. So if you think of the contours of a mountain, kind of like a layer cake, and you accidentally skip one, it's like taking the layer out of the layer cake and dropping the top of the cake down one contour interval. So that ends up getting revealed in the difference of the DEMs that pops up. Anyway, it ends up being a good measure of, good visually, a measure of where are the mapping, where are the glitches in the national elevation database. Skip over that too. Briefly, I said, you know, a lot of this data is used for a whole lot of things. USGS has been monitoring people downloading this data, and people download about 3 million quads a month. And this has been going on for years now. That's about one quad a second. So who is using this data? Well, apparently a lot of people, and they keep using it. Okay, more visualizations. Let's get back to that. If you want to read more about SRTM, this is an issue of Photogrammetric Engineering. Sunseam came out a year ago this month. I did the visualization on the front. I'm going to come back to this image. It's one of my favorite things. They wanted a cover for this journal. This issue is all about SRTM. And I was thinking, okay, well, we need something that really represents the mission. I have access to the entire global data set. You know, what makes a showy image? And of course, I'd looked at much of the world by that point. And the cratered highlands of East Africa were just stunning to look at. Volcanoes typically make great visualizations. But there's more things going on here, tectonics, fracking. I'll get back to that. Okay, you guys aren't the only ones wearing 3D glasses. This was actually when the shuttle was still in orbit. They're downlinking the data, making some 3D visualizations. I was making this 3D stuff. People were sending it back to Houston. The guys in Houston got off the 3D glasses and they were looking at it. So the shuttle was orbiting here when these guys were Okay, more 3D images. What can we see in this? Well, as a geologist, one interesting thing that topography shows you is it can actually give you a good indication of rock type, as you might guess. Different rock types erode different ways. And you get into a desert environment and you get carbonates, like limestone. The limestone sort of, to some degree, melts away under running water. So if you get stream channels, they tend to get they tend to erode down very steeply. You get notchy, sharp kind of erosional features. And that's what you're picking up here. This is in southern Oman, northeastern Yemen area. But you can see from the topography that, you know, you build up this texture and pattern that's indicative of carbonate rocks. If you look at a satellite image of Western Africa, you see a sand dune pattern, and you know, just looking fairly casually looking at the satellite image, why do you have that pattern? If you take the image, and this is actually 3D, you don't see many fringes here, but if you look at it in 3D, there's a cliff here with some notches in it. And I don't know from your perspective, but if you look at the various notches and the wind pattern, you can see that a lot of these sand dunes match up with the notches. Mm-hmm.
And so in 3D, you get an answer to the spatial pattern. You can see the spatial pattern on the Landsat image. You may not understand why that spatial pattern's there until you look at the topography and look at it in 3D. More information from visualization of topography. This is just kind of a showy image. These are images that were popular for media purposes. Mount Ararat in eastern Turkey and Kamchatka Peninsula. In this case, I'm taking a satellite image that's, of course, looking nadir in both these cases, and taking that image and looking at it completely horizontal, 90-degree rotation, drape it over an elevation model and look at it just straight on the side. And of course, you see the relationships then clearly with the snow line and tree line. Okay, more on the home front here. This picture has not been released. And there was some concern when I made it. It looks like Portland is doomed. Mount St. Helens, Portland down here. And a lot of the perspectives I make are orthographic, which means the scale isn't changing with distance, which of course gives you kind of a warped perception. Things in the distance have the same scale, they look like they're much closer. We haven't released this. Mount St. Helens is steamed at various times, and we thought it would be good to release it when that happens again. I think last time it happened, we had something landing on Mars or something, and we had too much competition, so we didn't hold the reserve. But anyway, they're concerned that it looks too threatening to Portland, but the case I've made is put some graphics on there, and the point of this image is actually that Portland is not terribly threatened, not threatened by surface flows up Mount St. Helens because of the Lewis River here. The flows going south will get caught by the river and go downstream from Portland down the Columbia River. So it actually shows that Portland's safe from that. Of course, it's not safe from ashfall, but it's a different issue. Some years ago, there was a volcanic eruption in Democratic Republic of Congo, the city of Goma, which I think has a million people, and lava was flowing right through the city, this volcano. This is a tropical area where you've got persistent cloud cover. The Aster satellite has good thermal channels and you can pick up the lava flows very distinctly. But we couldn't get a good cloud-free image. Landsat image would give us historical regative imagery, you get a fairly clear image. But we could pick up the lava flows through the clouds that, in various places. So I took that, what I could of the lava flows, it's an incomplete mapping, merged it with the Landsat, draped it over the SRTM data, and got an image that we could put out while this disaster was going on. Showing the relationship between the mountain and the city. The city shows up just in this bright area, and the lava flows going in the city. Okay, we talk about, of course, concern about NASA. With NASA, one of their emphasis is global change, and of course, sea level rise, and we've got a lot of people working on that in various ways. Something we can do with SRTM is just simple-minded, just raise the ocean, what land gets covered. Of course, as you've heard, Florida is in big trouble if the sea level rises 5 or 10 meters. Much of it goes underwater. This is one of those side-looking views of Landsat. This is a great vertical exaggeration. This is Salt Lake City. Interesting thing here is you see called the bathtub ring, the shoreline of the ancient Lake Bonneville, and it gets to the Wasatch Mountain front there. You can, of course, see that satellite image in map view, but when you take the side view and it all lines up as a straight line like this, it really becomes quite dramatic. It really looks like a bathtub ring. Malaspina Glacier in Alaska, it's just a nice view of it's an unusual banding patterns here. But, map merging with topography, you see the source glaciers and kind of see how it's kind of like a wrinkled carpet here with the valley glaciers that come down at high speed and come down to the coastal plain and the ice pushes into itself and kind of banding and gets something splashed up like a carpet. Cape Town, South Africa, just a color view of that, and you put on your glasses, look at that in 3D. Always great to
have something other than just shading to bring out the third dimension. Looks like a bunch of caterpillars or worms. These are, well, some of the salt domes are doubly plunging anticlines, geologic structure. In some cases, they have salt emerging from them as salt flows, kind of like lava flows. There's one here. A lot of tectonics going on in here. The ground's getting compressed north-south. A lot of folding and very clear view of geologic structure and again, salt popping out of the ground and flowing on top. View just pure view from Tartar. Los Angeles area, 15 million people waiting for the San Andreas Fault to move. It's just an image I made years ago for Ross Stein at U.S. Geological Survey. Earthquake paper either. This is the same area, this Los Angeles area, passing downtown Los Angeles and here, Pasadena here, San Diego Mountains. That's actually no vertical exaggeration, but it's a orthographic view. And if you put on your glasses, here we have 3D looking horizontal. I think everything I showed you up to this point was nadir looking view in 3D. Here I've taken, making perspective views looking almost horizontal, added parallax to that. And you can see various sub-ranges of the major range going in the distance. Interesting thing on these things, I don't know, probably can't do it in the auditorium here, but if you look at these on a computer screen and you move your head left and right, it moves with you. If you've been to Disneyland, you see this kind of illusion in the haunted house where you walk around and things move with you. You do that with these too. And of course, what that is you're perceiving 3D in reality. It isn't 3D, it's flat on the screen. So your mind's got to figure out something's happening here. And it just looks like motion. The only way your mind can interpret, you know, this non-changing pattern when you change your 3D perspective, at least it thinks you're changing your 3D perspective.
What's our eye spacing?
Something must be defined.
What's the eye spacing here?
The different angles is very small. When I first experimented with this, some of these things, like, you know, maybe 10 degrees or whatever, it's way too much. It's just a couple degrees. You know, I've talked to Sally Wright, the astronaut, and about perceiving topography from orbit, and of course, you know, you don't get parallax up there looking out the window. You know, your eyes are, what, 2.5 inches apart, and you're 100 miles up. The base to height ratio, which gives you parallax, just doesn't work from orbit. Oh, I can create it in a computer like this. Okay, another couple of examples of what elevation data set gives you. There's a Landsat image in Ghana, Nigeria. Satellite image gives no hint of topography at all. But if you take a DEM and just show it as brightness, clearly an erosional pattern here, stream channel pattern, shaded relief over there. For a lot of parts of the world, this is just a whole new perspective on the planet that we haven't had before. Shading, a lot of this Landsat imagery, the shading gives you a clue at the topography, but in some cases it doesn't give you any clue at all. Another example from Africa, enjoying rock types. Apparently, it looks like you've got two different rock patterns, maybe one layer over another. The upper layer is fractured and showing kind of an orthogonal erosional pattern, and when it seems to break through that, the pattern gets superimposed on the lower level, but then eventually you erode deep enough and it starts, patterns apparently migrate and become more dendritic. But you can see that, you know, you can infer things from the about the bedrock just from the topographic pattern. One of my favorite places, Bora Bora, just a kind of a showy image showing that Landsat image looking at optical and reflectance infrared wavelengths, shows you one thing, reflecting radar shows you something else, and the topography, of course, measures the height. Interesting thing between the radar and the Landsat, of course, Landsat's not separating the slightly above surface, well, on this display anyway, slightly above surface sand from the very shallow sand. There's a radar actually does that quite well on the land. The very narrow land is separated from water of any depth. Anyway, topography is getting a whole different dimension. Okay, this is kind of fun. This is Maps Google, or Google Maps, if you use that. And they actually use SRTM data for much of the world. But as I've said, you know, quite often we merge Landsat data and other satellite image data with the elevation models and get these nice perspectives. And you know, anything you map with the Landsat, now you project in 3D and you can fly around and all that kind of thing. But to some degree, you know, the satellite images give you more information, but to some degree it also masks information. I'll give you a good example of masking here. If you look at, there's a volcano here, these are all volcanoes. This is that crater highlights area I was talking about before. Nice volcano here, and the slope's coming down. But there's a very significant feature you can't quite see there. If you look at SRTM just by itself, it pops out. It's a different cropping here. But this is that same volcano. Look at this scar here, and this feature coming out onto the savanna here. What this is a landslide that came off the volcano and went running across, miles across the savanna. This is not unheard of. Back near Los Angeles, there's a landslide called the Black Hawk landslide, where the same kind of thing happened, where probably during an earthquake, the ground shook, very steep terrain broke up. Some of the terrain broke off, went down the slope, and just ran out across the valley for miles. Not very common, but not unheard of. Another example here that gets masked, as you saw, that same feature. If you look close enough, the scar is in here, and the runout is there. You know, you really have to know what you're looking for to see it. So sometimes visualization works with less data. Look at pure data sets. Chicxulub crater in Mexico. Interesting thing, you get the SRTM data, nice uniformly acquired DEM, not done quad by quad, nice uniform DEM. You pick up very subtle features. And generally, we're getting the resolution of, you know, it depends on the roughness of the topography, but 5 meter vertical resolution, 10, 14 meter vertical resolution. Get to the low relief terrain, so you're looking at broad features. In effect, you're averaging the data and getting a higher signal to noise ratio of the data. I mean, some of the subtle features pop out. And what we can see in the Yucatan Peninsula is some arcing features here. Now, the Chicxulub crater is supposedly the asteroid impact on the Earth that may have killed the dinosaurs. That crater has been buried by later sediments. But of course, over geologic time, the sediments can settle at different rates, and you might get a reflection of the lower bedrock structure in the overlying veneer. And that appears to be what's happening here. We get this kind of arc feature, which relates to the known crater from geophysical data that's centered out in this area. So it actually shows up in the water. Time taken to move ahead. This is just another example of showing hydrology in the Amazon basin. Pure topography, color-coded, shaded, really brings out all of the micro drainages there. It's been a great data set for the Amazon. This one I like. I guess this was known from USGS data, but I hadn't seen it before. These are the glacial moraines, Pleistocene glacial moraines from the Midwest, Chicago, Detroit. With these lines, it's just brightness is height and the elevation data. Different places where the glaciers left the rock deposits as they were retreating. They're stunning. Some geologic structure in Australia, Davenport Ranges. Interesting to you. Alpine Fault, New Zealand. I was actually driving along here 3 weeks ago. I knew what to look for. The road goes right through here. Again, you know, as you drive along there, if you don't know what you're looking for, you might not even, I'm a geologist, but you know, if you're not paying attention, you're just on vacation, you might not realize there's much of a
fault there, quite appreciate it's pure morphology, but boy, you sure see it in the topographic data. Just, your eye tends to be sensitive to horizontal lines and vertical lines, especially, more than diagonal ones. Straight as can be. Very prominent point. Okay, I talked about color images, that you can cross your eyes and get the color and the 3D at the same time. So take off your glasses. And I don't know, some of you may have done this, maybe this is old for you. But the trick here is you want to look at the left image with your right eye and the right image with your left eye. And I'm going to lead you through this a bit. We're going to come back to this. Okay, so we've got one dot. Have you cross your eyes, look at that one dot. Hopefully, you can see two dots. Okay, your eyes are not focused on the screen. Cross your eyes, and you can perceive two dots. It's sort of like, you've probably done this when you were a kid, stick up a finger, and you cross your eyes, and you see two fingers. Right? If you cross your eyes, look at this one dot, you should see two dots. Okay, now we've got two dots. Now cross your eyes, and you'll either see three dots or four dots. Each of those should become two, but if they overlap, do this. If they overlap, then you'll see three. And if you can do that, if you can make this look like three dots, then you can do the stereo routine. What I found is about a third of the people can never seem to get it. A third of the people find it fairly easy, and a third of the people, if they sit down in front of the screen for an hour, they will eventually get it. We're going to go back to that other image, and you look at the dots at the top. If you can cross your eyes and make those two dots up there look like three, then lower your eyes and look and see what you find. And what you should find is three of these images, and the middle one will be 3D. Anybody see that? Good, I just see something. This is really cool. You take color images of the Earth's surface, satellite images. In this case, it's just color-coded topography. You take satellite images, put it over the elevation model, generate these two stereo pairs, synthetic stereo pair. And your computer screen, again, without using any glasses of any kind, cross your eyes and see the world's surface in enhanced color in 3D. And that seems to be different for different people. I can actually make the dots go anywhere I want. I could do that the first time I tried it, so I don't know, some people can do it, some people don't. So. For those who can do it, a couple more briefly. This is in Patagonia, Argentina. Argentina is volcanic terrain, dry or not so dry lakes, thermal drainage lakes. A bunch of sinkholes, some of the black things are just black water holes. This is Meru Crater near Kilimanjaro in East Africa. Same kind of thing. So maybe a little harder. Okay, one. So most of you have probably not seen the 3D. I won't pester you with much more of that. What that crater looks like. You're just color-coding topography with that. Looks a lot like Mount St. Helens. This crater opens to the east. East is to the north here, but yes. You're rotated so it opens to the north. It looks a lot like the structure, topographic structure of Mount St. Helens. Probably that same kind of thing. Well, I do have one more of these. But I'm going to, for those of you who can't get it, I'm going to show a different version of this. This is a lake in Kamchatka. If you cross your eyes, if you just look at this one satellite picture, why is this lake here? You may not be able to figure that out just looking from the satellite picture. If you look at it 3D, the reason this lake is here, in fact, there's no lake this big anywhere else on the peninsula. If you cross your eyes to see 3D, you can probably see why this lake is here. Okay. Since most of you probably are having trouble with that, I don't know how you put on the glasses. We'll go to the next image. I'm going to take this area and rotate it like that. And enlarge it. Mm-hmm. Here's that lake again. Mm-hmm. Drainage is going off the big mountain crest here, going off to the west that way. there's a big ridge up here. Hopefully what you can see is there's a big landslide coming down here, creating a natural dam blocking the stream, and that's why this lake is here. So, again, if you just look at the satellite image, you may not be able to figure out this geography, you know, why is that big lake there? You add topography to the satellite image, it just jumps out of it. Big landslide dam. Okay, for time's sake, I'm gonna skip over this. This is some of the topographic difference. Mars analogs. Interesting, if you look at some of the satellite pictures, images, black and white images of Mars, JPL's getting. Look at various places on Earth with similar terrain, with shaded relief of the elevation model. Sometimes you get things that look quite similar. So here we have a Mars image on the left of what appears to be wind-eroded folds. I do think those are folds, not an illusion. And then terrain in western China, where we've got similar folds, extremely dry terrain that appears to be wind-eroded. You don't see stream integration there at all. Another case, tectonics. You can tell which image is the Mars image because of the craters along the line. But in the East African Rift, you get pull apart structures, two gravens as the ground spreads. Looks very similar to what you see on Mars. Impact craters, we have impact craters on Earth too. There's a picture on the left from Mars and a picture in Ghana, Africa. Just shaded relief in the middle of SRTM and height is brightness on the right. And the ejector ring, you can see on Mars coming around the crater here. The reason I showed brightness, height as brightness here, it shows it actually better than the shaded relief. You can see the ejector ring around here. They're quite similar. If you look at the satellite image, you just, you know, it's jungle. You don't see the ejector ring at all. Of course, you see the crater, but you don't see the ejector ring. Okay, well, 3D Mars, while you got the glasses. Talk about, you know, NASA's always very interested in water on Mars, and it's hard to believe there wasn't water on Mars if you look at this. It just looks like a stream channel with erosion coming down. What else would cause that? This Olympus Mons, the landslides coming off Olympus Mons, similar to what I was showing there in East Africa, Google Earth, and kind of way off the volcano. What planet is this? Which planet do you think that is? Very strange terrain. Again, that's East Africa Rift. Plate tectonics is completely shredding the land surface there. Okay, a few last disaster images here. And some of this was actually taken from Bob Gates' web pages, so some of this is stolen from OSU. But some of it, you guys haven't seen it before, I guess. This is Landsat imagery draped over, in this case, it's SRTM, I believe. Astro imagery draped over SRTM. This is before the big Kashmir earthquake and a landslide, as you'll see. And here's after. Okay. Now I'm going to flicker that back and forth. And even though it's only two frames, it's almost like a movie. I suggest you look. I'm going to flicker this several times. Sometime while I'm flickering, look. Just keep your eyes focused here. Other times, keep your eyes focused here. And you almost get a sense. It's almost like a movie of it. Slide coming down. Notice the slide's coming down from way up high, comes down into the canyon, goes up the other side of the canyon. That's a stunning, huge slide there. Here's the image setting. Talk about Bob's website, taken by Wiley Thompson, who was there, who's also with him. Some of these images. And I get an idea of how huge this site is. These bright spots of her actually buildings. Volume is like measuring from the elevation model. So it's not just visualizations we get, obviously, from DEMs, but quantitative measurements. The slide volume I got was 75 million cubic meters, and that's big. Can I fill height 248 meters? What is that? It's like 800 feet or so. Space Needle in Seattle, 600 feet. This is 200 feet above that. Very tall natural dam. Potential lake volume, again, you get that from the elevation model, 42 million cubic meters. In place of danger, and some of this was taken from Bob's site too, but I'll get to that in a second. 3D visualization, I'm going to flicker this again. So now you can see the landslide come down, flicker back and forth, sort of looks like a movie, but it's in 3D. That study. That's actually from the astrospheric pair, not from the elevation model.
So do you think it's on the edge of an older landslide star?
Oh, there are landslides, that's all summarized in another slide here in a second. Landslides all over the place. You can find evidence for such slides in other places from the hillside morphology. Also, the, you know, as you would guess, once you've got the landslide dam coming down, you're going to create lakes in here, and you're going to fill with sediment, and you're going to get flat layers in the lake sediment. And eventually that will erode through, but you'll be left with terraces. Well, you look other places around here, you can see terraces that, and landslide scars that, where this process seems to have happened before. They're largely eroded now, which means none of them are too terribly young. But clearly, this kind of process has happened in this area before. It's no surprise. Okay, so the hazard scenarios directly off Bob's website, looking at this. And this is an ongoing potential problem. This just happened, what, a year and a half ago? The lake has not filled yet to go over that dam. One of the concerns, of course, is that when it fills, it goes over the dam. It's this unconsolidated material that erodes, and you get a catastrophic release of water. Positive feedback kind of thing. If water flows, it erodes. Causing a bigger channel, flows more, erodes more, you have something approaching a million people downstream.